This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're traveling right now with Pico Iyer. Pico's latest book is The Man Within My Head. Our theme right now is finding stillness in your travels. Pico, why would you want to find stillness? What's the joy of quiet for you?
I think movement only makes sense when you have enough stillness to collect your thoughts, to collect yourself, to step out of the rush of the modern world and begin to understand it and begin to understand yourself. And it's interesting, 20 years ago, I have a friend who teaches high school locally in Santa Barbara, California, and he told me that although he's not a Catholic and his students aren't, he always took them to a Catholic monastery for 3 days. And he said, even the most testosterone-driven, restless, hormone-addled 15-year-old Californian boy got into silence and he fell ever quieter, happier, calmer. And he said many of his students after 2 days never wanted to leave. And I thought anything that works for a teenage boy
should be. See, there's a hunger for that.
There's
a hunger for that. Do you know the monastery in France called Taizé?
I've read about it. It's one of my dreams to go there.
I, as a tour guide, blindsided 24 American tourists by taking them there without explaining what it was.
They're in your debt for the rest of your life.
Well, half of them loved it, and half of them were going to do a class action lawsuit. I think it was because Americans really have a fear of silence. And part of Taizé is silence.
Yes.
Taizé is this ecumenical, youthful monastic movement in Europe where they have beautiful chanting. A lot of churches all over the world have the Taizé music. And you would kneel and look at these icons and hear this spiritual music sung by angelic people from all over the European Union. And for some people, it was magical. Mm. And I thought it was so appropriate to get off of the rat race as a tourist and spend just a couple of days in a monastic kind of place like that. But I think as a tour guide, you need to warm people up to it and explain to it. But let's say you're a tour guide. Where would you find silence in your travels?
I think Kyoto is one of the great places. And everybody is very moved by the gardens of Kyoto because as soon as you get there, something in you opens up. And what the Japanese are so clever with, having worked on silence for 1,000 years, is, as you know, there's always the sound of running water there. And that actually makes the silence even more of a presence. It's not just the absence of noise. It's the presence of some richness there. And of course, I think the American West is rich in silence. Places in Alaska around Denali are as full of a quietude and space. And
but you can find silence even in a chaotic setting.
Yes, that's the trick.
That's the trick. I was just on a cruise ship, 3,000 people packed onto a floating Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
I could find silence.
Yes.
You had to make a point. But when I found that silence, it was like, let's write a poem. It was just powerful. It was beautiful. There's a loggia in Venice on St. Mark's Basilica overlooking the square. Mm. You can stand there all alone and just look at the sea of people, hear the white noise of all this crowd that comes in like the tide, you know?
Mm.
And there's a sort of a beautiful silence there.
Yes.
And then every little baby's cry, every little seagull becomes part of the melody of it, the orchestration of it. But it's a discipline to find that, I think.
But important, because I think when we take holidays, we know that we want to see the sights. We know we have a long list of things to do. But it's really the things that are not on the to-do list, the invisible things, that aren't the sights that transform us.
Mont Saint-Michel, everybody's going to go to the church on top of that mountain. Mm. But if you just take off your shoes and walk 300 yards out into the mud flat, you'll know what a hermit monk is.
I'll go out at 5 in the morning if I'm in a foreign town, and I feel as if I have the whole place to myself.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Pico Iyer about the joy of quiet in our travels. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Jean's on the phone in Terre Haute, Indiana. Jean, thanks for your call.
Glad to be on.
Do you have a comment or a question for Pico?
From his work, part of what has struck me is this sense of spirituality in his relationship to the places that he's been, which resonates for me in my own travels. And actually, one of the things I was reflecting on was that it was traveling by myself that created a lot of that for me. And I've done that off and on over the years, initially as a 21-year-old college student in Asia. Everybody said that was going to be very scary, frightening. My parents didn't really want to know where I was going. But in truth, the richness of having that experience of just engaging with the complexity of these cultures that I had the privilege of being with, has had a tremendous power for me. So my question for him is, you know, was there a point where he perhaps realized that and engaged with that quality, where he became aware that was a part of it?
Thank you, Jean. I must say you're braver than I am, because I think a lot of the things I do, I would think twice about doing if I was a woman. And I'm also helped by the fact I have a dark complexion, so I kind of can pass as a local in many places. But you're absolutely right. I'm an only child, and I grew up traveling alone a lot. So that's what's natural to me. But I so agree with you that you're much more open to everything around you. People are much more likely to come up to you in the street. Everything to me is much richer when I'm by myself. If I'm traveling with somebody else, I'm almost taking my regular everyday self with me, and I'm kind of locked into the same patterns and conversations I have at home. So I do, when I find a beautiful place, I excitedly go home, and then I take my wife there, or I try to introduce it to my mother. But I think the really transforming moments have been when I'm alone. And I loved what you said at the beginning of your question. I always think of Thoreau saying, I measure travel inwards. I measure distance inwards. And to travel and to descry new thoughts is to just have new imaginings. And I think when people talk about being moved and transported, they're not really talking about a Boeing 747 or an Amtrak train. It's something inward that is what we bring back from it. And so when you mentioned about spirituality, I think the beauty of travel is it gives you moments that expand your sense of yourself, and that you can't necessarily put into words, but you know you come back a different person from the one who set out.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's what I experienced just on a city street, though, that it was simply being immersed in the everyday being of places that I was. That if I'd been with a companion, would have been chatting with them.
Exactly.
Or I would have been aware of what were they thinking. But very different from simply having that experience for myself.
You know, Jean and Pico, I've always wondered if I was going to dedicate 3 or 4 weeks to doing the Camino de Santiago and walk across Spain with all the pilgrims, would I want to do it alone, or would I do it with a partner or a group? It's a tough issue, I think. What would you do, Pico?
I'd set out alone, but I'd probably be doing it in search of community and fellowship.
But rather than starting with that partner, which really does shape the way you interact with the whole experience.
Yes, and it removes you from it, just as Jean was saying. You're worried if the other person is enjoying it.
Jean, thanks so much for your call.
You're very welcome.
Happy solo travels.
Thank you. Same to you.
Pico, I believe most of your books are shelved in the literary section rather than guidebooks. To what degree would you say your books are guidebooks in disguise?
I think they're guides what not to do, and often guides of where not to go. For example, I don't recommend North Korea to anybody, but I thought I should go there as a fun experiment. So I think they're not guidebooks. As you know, I started out my life writing for Let's Go when I was a graduate student many years ago. But I think my books are more explorations. And just a couple of days ago, I came across this great sentence by G.K. Chesterton, the English writer. And he said, our challenge is how to remain at once astonished by the world and at home in it. And I think they're about that.
You know, I've always wondered if big cultures in our world rub together like tectonic plates, there's going to be some earthquakes. When I say that, what comes to mind to you? Where would you see the earthquakes, and how can you see us learning about recognizing the big cultures and how they try to connect?
I mean, America and China is the first one that comes to my mind. I'm just about to take my first trip to Iran, and I know you've been there, and I'm interested in how these two classic cultures are rubbing against one another. And I must say, I began my travels long ago by finding out which countries were in the Trading with the Enemies Act of the Treasury Department. Not that I wanted to befriend our enemies, but I thought, these are the countries that I'll never hear about in California, and they'll never hear about me. So in those days, China, Vietnam, Cuba, North Korea, and I thought it was such an interesting exercise because, as you know, the first thing you find whenever you go to an enemy country is that most of the individuals are our friends and very, very excited to meet Americans and want to come to America in many instances. So just a way of cutting below the stereotypes that it's so easy for us to carry around.
And when we make those people-to-people contacts with our trading enemies or whatever that list is, suddenly it becomes more difficult for their propaganda to do its work on their people to demonize us.
Yes.
And it makes it more difficult for our propaganda to do its work to demonize them.
Exactly. And one reason I go as a dark-skinned person of Indian origin to, let's say, the Middle East, is to remind somebody in Syria that a typical American now is somebody like me, who's as dark as they are, who's deeply interested in their culture, wants to learn about Islam, and who's traveled 7,000 miles to learn about Damascus. So I'm not the American stereotype that they may carry or that their government may propagate, as you were saying.
So what's this bucket list called again? Trading with the enemy?
Yes. I don't know what countries are on it now.
What is the name of it? Is it actually a thing? Is there actually?
Yes, the treasury. So you're allowed to go there, but you're not allowed to spend money there.
Yeah, that was my problem with Iran. I mean, we could go there, but we couldn't consume anything. It was a very fine line. I had to get a lawyer to make sure we didn't break any laws. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're speaking with Pico Iyer. Pico's newest book is The Man Within My Head. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Eileen's on the phone in Bonnie Lake, Washington. Eileen, thanks for your call.
Hi there. I'm so delighted to be on the phone with both of you, actually. So I do have a couple of questions for Pico. How often do you travel now? As opposed to, you know, I've been reading you for years.
Much less. I think you already anticipate the answer. And one of the great luxuries for me is staying at home. And since my home is rural Japan, there's lots as exotic to me even there. So, and I've been lucky enough to see many of the places I'm really hungry to see. So what I do now often is go back to places, the way that I'm almost happier to meet an old friend now than to try to find a new friend, because you don't have to introduce yourself. You can pick up where you left off. And it's a much deeper conversation. So in terms of seeing new places, I see maybe one new place every year at this point.
Okay. And as far as going back to some of your other places, I have a my own term for that. I call it trip visiting, because you're basically going back and, you know, inserting yourself into a friend's lifestyle and helping them out for a while. And it's very rewarding. How many of those trips do you make a year?
Many more. I'm visiting Seattle at the moment. It's one of my favorite cities in North America, and it's always changing, and I'm always changing, so the dialogue is always a little different. It'd be hard for me to put a number on it, but there are places like Thailand or Singapore that I've probably been to 50, 60 times in my life, and I'm always excited to go to them again. Yes.
Yes. Well, everything changes. And
yes.
Absolutely. Okay, so rural Japan is where it feels like home to you now. Did you pick that for that reason, or did you end up there for a different reason?
I did pick it, and I think we're again lucky. We're the first generation that can perhaps live in the countries we've always dreamed of. So when I was a little boy, I was always reading Japanese poems, looking at Japanese paintings. I felt this mysterious sense of familiarity. And strangely enough, even after I first went there, instantly I felt I recognized these streets more than I recognized the street on which I was born. And so I left New York City and a nice job that I had there, and I decided I have to live in Japan. And that was 25 years ago, and I've never looked back. It's a country I want to learn from. It's a country that makes sense to me, and it's my kind of mysterious secret home.
Eileen, thanks a lot for your call.
You bet.
Okay, bye now. Pico, that is a sort of a luxury and a success in itself, is just taking the opportunity and the freedom to actually find the place that's right for you, to psychoanalyze where do you belong on this planet.
Yes, it's like, again, finding the perfect partner. And, you know, I often talk about the excess of technology, but of course I couldn't live in Japan without this technology. And even 30 years ago, although if I loved Japan, it would be still hard for me to live in Japan and have all my bosses in New York, as is the case now. But now...
Now you can.
Now we can, and so, yeah.
What are the fundamental differences that you see, if you're going to distill it down, between East and West?
East is much more inner, I would say. And East, therefore, is hungry for the material affluence we have, and West is hungry for the spiritual affluence that the East seems to have.
So we've got the speed and noise, and they want the speed and noise, and we want some of their thoughtfulness and contentment.
And we've also got modernity and innovation and freedom, and they have antiquity and wisdom. And I think we have the future tense to some degree, and they have the past, and everyone needs both.
And then what do you see as the fundamental differences between Europe and the United States?
Same thing, the difference between the old world and the new world. I think they're very good at nuance and we're very good at directness. And each has a lot to learn from the other. And I speak as somebody who grew up between England and California. And as soon as I came to California, I loved the long horizons and the freedom from the past. And as soon as I went back to England, of course, I loved the past.
That's a beautiful thing about travel, is it's like eating at different restaurants.
Mm.
And I've been really mindful of the fact that there's a lot of fear in our society these days. How does travel relate to fear?
Travel is a leap of faith. And recently, I've used travel almost as a way into my fear and therefore through it. I think Camus famously said, "What gives value to travel is fear." I was in Sri Lanka a few years ago. I found myself in the middle of a civil war. It was peaceful when I planned my trip, but by the time I arrived, the civil war had broken out. I was climbing a huge rock face, and I remembered I'm terrified of heights. I asked the driver what was around us. He said, "There are snakes everywhere." I have a bit of a phobia of snakes. And it was a difficult, difficult trip. But at some point, I thought, well, this is a good thing, because all these fears are not going to go away by my just turning my back on them. And maybe by confronting them and trying to step through them, I will come back a little less unsettled by heights. So at least I'll always remember, well, I did climb that rickety staircase from the London Underground 1,000 feet above the Sri Lankan jungle. I actually conquered my fear briefly.
I was looking at your face as you were recalling all of these great results of tackling fear. And I don't think you or I would ever, nobody would look at us and say, oh, there's a mighty risk-taking adventure, you know.
Right.
But we go to places that we are a little uncertain about, and we get out of our comfort zones. Mm. And if I think back on the really powerful experiences I've had, whether it's taking an iron cableway around a cliff that I did last summer, that was scary for me physically, a Via Ferrata in the Swiss Alps, going down to Central America during the difficult civil wars there, going to Iran a little while ago, traveling through India, being, you know, with some scary cab driver in Moscow, going out to the airport. These have been very frightening things for me. But I don't think any of them were really reckless in riskiness. They were just embracing the world and learning from it. Travel can make us conquer our fears, I guess, or turn them into something positive.
It's like falling in love. And I think fear is based on ignorance. I remember when I began traveling in the 1980s, like you, I was in Central America and Cuba and places ostensibly dangerous.
Right.
And then I read that in 1988, I think, Washington, D.C. had a higher murder rate than Kabul, Beirut, and San Salvador, all in the middle of war. And we forget that for many people in the world, the really scary places are Los Angeles and New York. And I often also think that if I were in an office for 50 weeks of every year, or if I were at home looking after kids, when I had a holiday, all I would want is Hawaii or somewhere full of sunshine and ease, and I understand that. But like you, I'm lucky enough to get to travel a lot. And so, just like you, I live in a very comfortable place in Japan. So when I travel, I want to see places as different as possible. I want to go to Yemen or Ethiopia or Haiti because they will shake me up the most and give me a very different reality from the one that I know.
You're listening to Travel with Rick Steves, and we've been speaking with Pico Iyer. Pico's latest book is The Man Within My Head. Pico, one great thing about travel is it humbles you. You're very self-assured and suddenly realized, oh, I guess I had it wrong. Have you found that in your travels?
Even in India, which is the country of my ancestors, it rearranges your soul. And India is like shock therapy. And it's even for me, it's almost too intense. But I always come out of India feeling, well, I've confronted something important and I will learn from it.
And you've learned from it. Pico Iyer, thank you so much for sharing with us in your books and being with us today.
Thank you. It's been a real delight, Rick.
And I break above the waves. I feel the sun upon my face.
Pico Iyer shares many of his observations from his travels and a few photos, too, on his website at picoiyerjourneys.com. That's PicoIyer. And we have a link to that in this week's radio program details at ricksteves.com. Up next, let's consider a trip to Cape Town in South Africa. It's long been a favorite getaway for London-based travel writer Will Hyde. We'll discover why it might just become your favorite destination as well, next on Travel with Rick Steves. Our phone number is 877-333-7425.